This Torah portion is a little bit of an enigma. God tells Moses to send the people to spy out the land. The opening question is, why would God send the people to spy out the land if God knows that the spying of the land is going to end up in a bad thing? That is, that they're not going to have the opportunity to enter into the promised land. The people should have asked themselves this question. Why would God have chosen a land that was not good? Now, why did they even need to spy out the land? I mean, after all, if a parent is going to give a child a gift, the child can pretty much assume, I think, that the gift is a nice one. The parent thinks that the parent cares for the child, and the parent is going to give a nice gift to the child. Why would the children of Israel presume that they have to somehow or another check out the land of Israel? God knows, according to the commentators, that the people want to spy out the land. And therefore, already in the Talmudic period, according to the opinion of Reish Lakish, he says, go ahead, God says to Moses, go ahead and spy out the land according to your opinion, according to what you want to do. In other words, there's no necessity to do this. We already know what the result is going to be. We already know what's in the land. But if you want to go ahead, you go ahead. According to your opinion, go. So already in the Talmud, we find out that the people are, that God is treating the people kind of like we treat our children, right? Those of you who have children, I suspect at one point or another, you allow them to make a mistake. And you knew where it was going to go, right? But you said, you know, you want to argue about it, fine. Go ahead. You know, what will be is what will be. But the Torah can be understood on more than one level. So on the superficial level, on the level of the surface, we have the story of the children of Israel wanting to go off in their own direction, God understanding that, and yet it's not going to come to the best of results. But there's another level as well, I suspect. Perhaps we're told to spy out the land. We're also being told to look within ourselves. In other words, Moses says, go and take a look. Well, we can go and take a look at that which is outside, but we can also go and take a look at that which is inside. So where it says shlach lecha, shlach would have been sufficient. The Hebrew word shlach means go. Okay, so why does the Torah have to say shlach lecha? It can mean, as is also interpreted in Genesis chapter 12, where it says lech lecha, go into yourself. So Moses says shlach, send people where? Lecha, into yourself. Had the spies come back with a spiritual report of the land, everything would have been fine. You know, had they understood the spirituality of what they were involved in, they would have come back and said, you know what, we're not so happy with some things about the land, but God is sending us. We understand that we're on a spiritual mission here. It'll be okay. I mean, look where they had been, right? They just got out of Egypt. So we understand that it could have been all right. But instead they came back, and although they could have said the land was good, they came back with this report of their own perception, right? Their own internalized perception. We cannot conquer the land. There are giants living there. We're like grasshoppers in comparison to them. Taking note of such a report, it would have been good for the people to say, if God is giving us this land, why do we feel like we can't conquer it? I mean, if they felt that way, why did they not just say to themselves, you know, there's a contradiction here. God is giving us a gift. God would not give us a bad gift. Why are we feeling internally that we can't conquer the land? It must be something not external, but something internal within us. And perhaps we should therefore look within. What is there, therefore, in this process that prevents us from seeing the spirituality of the land or anything that God intends for us to do? You know, most of us understand that normative Judaism is about our external actions, right? We're commanded to eat certain things, to practice certain holidays, to take certain stands that are moral, to do certain moral things. It's not generally about our internal motives. It's generally not about what you believe. It's generally about what you do. We focus on our relationship with God and the deeds that will make that real in our lives. But interestingly, if you study Hasidism, it's interesting that this came right before Freud, 100 years before Freud. I mean, it really is interesting if you think about it. Hasidism changed the approach. In Hasidism, we see a focus on the internal motivations of the self in terms of performing God's commandments. I want to emphasize for those of you who are interested in the history of thought, Freud got there later than the Hasidic movement did. The opening of this week's parashah, which we just read, tells us that the spies are supposed to send a group to represent all of the people. But then it tells us that each of the spies are individuals. Remember when I read each echad? Each one is sent as an individual. So yes, they are representing the group, the household of Israel, but here the text takes pains to say each person is going as an individual, as if to say each person is going on their own unique spiritual search, because no one can go on anyone else's spiritual search. Ish echad, each person by their own, and then the text goes on to list who went. Well, each person's name is given. Such a journey requires a great amount of personal honesty and great self-knowledge. I frequently note how teenagers seem to always place blame on someone else when anything goes wrong. I'm sure if you all have teenagers, you hear this all the time. The teacher didn't follow up on what I my absence and didn't give me the notes, right? The teacher didn't explain clearly what was going on. Hey, my friend forgot to give it to me, right? I left my homework home. Why didn't you remember to put it on the kitchen table where I would have known to take it? Part of spiritual maturity is asking ourselves the question, how am I responsible for this? Why didn't I get closer to God? Not why didn't it happen for me, but what was there within me? What are the impediments such that this didn't happen for me? So the spiritual journey within begins with self-knowledge. We ask ourselves what it is that is tripping up my spiritual journey. There are two common answers to that question that I'd like to focus on just for a few moments. The first is, I'm having trouble giving up my idols. Now, I know everybody thinks idolatry is something that existed in the Bible. But idols are those things that serve our needs. The reason we don't give up our idols is because the prophets tell us that the idols are the works of our hands, right? We don't give them up because we like them. We make them for a reason. Idols tell me I'm a terrific person. I'm accomplished. I'm good in the community. People like me. They place me in the center of God's creation, right? Look how important I am. Because they are the work of my hands and my own mind, I'm now in the center. So we like to congratulate ourselves for our achievements. Doing really well in the world. Look what a good guy I am. Look at what a good person I am. And idols are often held by our entire culture. So we believe that we must be right because everyone else believes the same thing. How could all people be wrong? How could common wisdom be so wrong? Yet somewhere inside we sense that we are headed in the wrong direction. So look at where our culture is taking us, and this is not a sermon slot long enough to talk about all the things, but you all watch TV. You see the advertisements. You know that the common wisdom is a wisdom that leads us to nowhere. God speaks within in a still small voice, as Elijah said, when he first noted it at Mount Sinai. I believe that still small voice exists, but we choose not to hear the voice. It's there. And it says to us, regardless of what the people around you say you should be doing, regardless of what it says in the magazines, regardless of those pictures and the TV advertisements, you're headed in the wrong direction. We know it. Discovering our idols takes deep concentration and extraordinary devotion to our inner truth. And it's so painful that we'd rather just say, you know, the world says go in a different direction, and it's a lot easier. Which brings me to the second point. Listening to the answer of what God requires of me, identifying my idols and knowing where I should go, may be highly inconvenient, as in an inconvenient truth. God told Jeremiah to preach about the destruction of Judah. Jeremiah was living a pretty good life. But he was told to preach about the sins of the people, and it ruined his life. The people hated him. He would have been much better off ignoring that inner voice and obeying his idols. He would have been much better off just giving in to the culture. Being better off means living a more peaceful life. But Jeremiah, the prophet, chose an inner truth that he could identify. And thus he paved the way for the people to understand what went wrong with their lives and how they might correct it after the destruction of their temple in Jerusalem. He didn't live to see that end product. But his preaching put people in the right direction. His message was unpopular, but it was essential. So the encounter with spiritual truths, unlike today, by the way, in which people, boy, come out of these Sunday morning services and they come out of watching the stuff on TV and they believe they're going to be successful and they're going to be saved and the world continues in a bad way. Because they focus on what is convenient for them. Today in American culture, we look for an inner journey that will make us feel good. As if God loves middle-class America, but hates the poor, the sick, the disenfranchised, the despised by culture. We think if everyone agrees with that, it somehow must be right. Shock jocks are making a great living off of it. Many preachers feast on the idolatries of our culture while preaching about God. But there does exist that still small voice within that speaks volumes about God's place in our lives and our world, if we're willing to discover it. The voice is quiet. But you know what? It's harmonious. It truly is. It gives you an incredible sense of tranquility within. And it is very insistent, even though quiet. You cannot make it go away if you're willing to listen. It's against compromise. It says, I will not be compromised. And it is very patient. We accommodate our idolatries because we do not want to deal with truths. But God cries at our estrangement. For the more we deny the truth, even with God's patience, somehow the further we remove ourselves from that softer voice within that speaks of God. This week's Torah portion tells us, if the external search for the promised land is to be successful, then the internal search for God must be sincere and it must be direct. The external search for the promised land is dependent upon what happens within. And frankly, that's something the Hasidism added to the Jewish world that cannot, ought not be ignored. As Pirkei Avot teaches in the name of Rabbi Tarfon and has taught for 2,000 years, ours is not to complete the spiritual task, neither are we free to desist from it altogether.